Okay, hello, welcome to H3. My name is Alan Friesen, the acapellist, and with me is Brother Scott Sweetman. How are you doing tonight, Brother Scott?
Hey, well, snow, I'm getting used to it, right? This is what, our third day now, our fourth day of snow?
Exactly. It's cold and snowy here. The roads are a mess. We're sliding all over with our cars. Yeah, it's just winter, and so that's what makes us tough, being able to withstand winter. So
lots of accidents too the last couple of days, right?
Mm-hmm. The first time when we get snow, it's often where, you know, people have to get their kind of their snow legs on kind of a thing in order to be able to drive properly. So yeah,
you know what was really interesting in Nagoya, the city we lived in, and it wasn't too far out of the mountains and snow, is the taxi drivers would put one wheel with chains on it. So they were all front wheel drive, and they would only put one wheel on. And I never could find out if that was to get around some legislation, or because you would see them and the one tire would be, you know, no chain. And I talked to one student and he said, oh, they've got some differential lock or something, like the one wheel won't spin.
Oh yeah.
If the other one's got traction or anyway, it was interesting, but yeah, until I went there, I'd never seen. When I was a kid, change just went on in the wintertime, and that was it, like our farm trucks and everything.
Yeah,
you know, you never, of course, you didn't have time, or if you're out in the middle of a field trying to feed animals and it's 40 below, you don't want to then decide you're going to chain up, right? So
No, exactly. And if it's a farm vehicle that's going slow and running on fields and that kind of stuff is different than running them on pavement, right? So, yeah.
Although we did have one come off a dually once and blast right through the fiberglass wheel well.
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty dramatic. We were in the truck at the time, smashed out the back window too.
We
thought we'd been shot at because just there was this huge bang and the back window exploded inward, right?
But huh.
Not so much. It was just a chain on the truck. And then my dad, of course, flipped out because we must not have put them on right.
Yes, of course. Of course. Exactly. Blame the help.
Yeah, exactly. The free help, I might add. How's Corolla doing in the snow and the horses?
Well, we've had waters freeze up and vehicles not starting, but I think we're past those now. We've been change up this and fix that, and so I think we're good now. So yeah.
Oh, cattle waters, man! I remember chopping holes in them and trying to keep them ice free at like minus. I'm from farther north than Lethbridge, and it got quite a bit colder there, but.
Yes.
Animals, I don't, you know, if as long as they have protection from the wind, they can endure really cold temperatures. But if there's wind, it, you know, cuts through that fur pretty quick. So
Exactly. You see them sometimes where they'll all kind of like bundle up together in a big huddle kind of a thing, right? And the ones outside, I guess, are taking the wind and the rest are protected by those animals. So, yeah. Yeah.
And I've actually slept with horses in that sort of horse pile. It was not a dog pile, but it's a horse pile. And it's really warm and comfortable. And horses won't normally step on living things.
Right.
They'll avoid it at all costs. I mean, if they're scared and charging, then there's, or if you're a farrier, then, you know, or they just casually step on your foot. They might do that on purpose sometimes, but usually like I slept a couple of times, more than a couple, with the horses in their pen or in the paddock or whatever, when they were sick or we were protecting them from something. And never, ever got hurt. Never froze to death. They were always snuggled up against me in the morning and pretty amazing.
You know that band Three Dog Night?
Yes.
Do you know what that Three Dog Night is about? That's a real cold night, right? Where you'd have to sleep with three dogs to keep yourself warm from freezing to death, right?
So yeah, well, we only have two in our house, and they do like to sleep up with people. But if it's a three dog night, I guess we're in trouble here. I'm not
exactly.
Sure. Exactly. Have you ever slept with animals, Al? You're not a
cat. Yeah, cats. Yeah, probably when I was a kid, I slept with dogs. We had dogs at home, so yeah.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah.
I had a boxer when I was young called
nice.
Duke. Oh, Duke. Yeah. He's a great dog. Yeah. And we had a game where I would go on the swing and I'd swing. And then when I'd come down, he'd be there and I'd kick him with both my legs, right? And push him back like about 6 feet. And then, you know, swing away again, then do it again, right? And so we'd play that game for hours, right? He never bit or hurt me, but it was like, you know, that was just getting the thump in the chest. And yeah, so yeah.
The first dog we had after my parents' divorce were like that. His name was Killer, right? Yeah. But like Duke. So like my brother and I would don big leather gloves and like leather work clothes, and we'd sneak up on him. Not really. He knew we were there. And one of us would grab his front, the other would grab his back legs and try and hold him down. Well, of course, he'd snarl and carry on. He could have bit us anytime, but he never did. And then we'd let him go, and he'd run in circles around us for like 20 minutes, and then we'd catch him again. So, yeah. Duke and Killer are probably up in heaven playing right now.
Probably. I know that Duke was not friendly to cats. Man, if cats came around, he would kill all kinds of cats. So, he was brutal with cats. So, yeah.
My Rottweilers, one time, they were staying over at someone's house. You know, you tell people, it's funny because even with our Akita now, we're like, yeah, he's not, you have to warm up to him, right? Like he doesn't, and people, oh no, I'm good with dogs. And of course they start reaching for him. Yeah, boy, if an owner tells you the dogs need to be left alone, then they need to be left alone. But yeah, this person let them out for some exercise like 15 minutes before I got there. I come around the corner. I hear this awful howling noise. And my Rottweilers have a feral cat, one of them on one end and one on the other end. And let's just say they parted ways. And I've seen all kinds of stuff, but I'm there. It was quick, but it was gruesome. And can't really blame the dogs. That's what they do, right? Like
exactly.
People were to blame there.
The
cat's death was completely on the hands of people, not the dogs. But
exactly.
Whatever.
So speaking about our nature, our basic nature, mm-hmm. Dr. James, who I've been loving his book.
Oh, and 7 minutes in the topic of tonight's show.
We're going to get to the topic. Exactly. That he is talking about basically where you have to understand what is good for a human, just as you would understand what is good for a dog, what is good for a cat, what is good for an elephant. And then if they have the things that they need that are valuable for their health and well-being, they're going to be healthy, right? They're going to have good lives. They're going to have good energy, that kind of thing. So basically, if you eat well, move well, and think well as it relates to humans, you're going to enjoy good health because of that robust health. And so one of the things, I've been reading his book. I've been loving his book. It's really good. So I actually started reading it now. We have a sauna that I've never used. So I stand in the sauna and read his book is what I've been doing now.
Doesn't it get a little moist in there?
Oh, it does. And the pages all got sweat all over them. And yeah, exactly. But
What I really like about Dr. Chestnut's stuff is it's evidence-based, right? That's his big thing. Like, unless they can prove it, unless it's repeatable, unless it's science, you know, and he doesn't pull any punches. If it's just, I think this might, that's what you get. Unless it's proven and researched, you don't get the, oh, you know, four people in Topeka, Nebraska say this, you know, help them. He approaches it very scientifically, and he evolves his position, which I also like, right? Like if you look at his earlier stuff, he goes back and say, well, you know, I need to append this way, or I need to adjust this way. And there's been more research in this area. And I think that's fantastic. Like I really enjoy his stuff for that reason.
And he's from British Columbia, Canada. Woohoo! Thank Another you, Dr. Canada. James Chestnut.
That's and fantastic, so though.
What I wanted to share with you today is just a little bit. I'm going to go shopping with my bride, so we are not going to have a long show tonight. But what I wanted to share with you is that, he says, this is like early on in the book, where he talks about, I've lectured to university and postgraduate students, medical, chiropractic, naturopathic doctors, and to lay people in large public theaters. Having been interviewed for documentaries and radio, given presentations to government healthcare panels and at scientific conferences, and taught at high school and university levels. However, I can honestly say that lecturing about health to 10-year-olds was one of my most challenging and rewarding experiences of my career. kids are so smart, intuitive, and honest about what they think. They also give you their unfiltered opinions, whether you ask for them or not. So anyways, he talks that he grew up, met this group of 10-year-olds at the request of the teacher, who the teacher was a fan of his logic and his advice, right?
Right.
And he says, like I always do, I started my lecture by asking some questions to get the audience engaged in the act of thinking. I believe that most people have enough knowledge to answer many of the right questions. They have just not thought enough to ask them. I asked the students if their health was important. All agreed it was. Mm-hmm. Makes sense? I then asked them if they could think of anything that was more important. None could. I asked the students whether eating an apple or a donut would make them healthier. All agreed to the apple. Then I asked if exercising would make them healthier than not exercising. All agreed it would. Next, I asked whether positive thoughts, feelings, and relationships would make them healthier than negative ones. They unanimously agreed on positive ones. Then I asked whether they would give a puppy soda or soft drinks or water. They all said water. I asked whether they feed a puppy healthy dog food or potato chips. They agreed on healthy pet food, healthy puppy food. So basically, it's just kind of, you know, kids 10 years old get it, right? And sometimes we, through just habits, don't, right? We do things we know are not good for our bodies, right? Why is that, right? Why do we do that, right? So anyways, I love that just to kind of, yeah, this makes sense. And then he also asked about, you know, would you keep your puppy indoors and that it never went outside and, you know, never had sunlight and never ran in the grass? And of course, no, they'd want the puppy to run outside and get exercise and be, you know, have that vigor in their bodies and that movement, right? So, and a lot of different physiology or wellness type folks talk about it differently. They talk about kinetic flow, right? Mm-hmm. So what is it called? Hormesis, where your body, you're doing the challenges for your body, and that challenge, your body rises to that challenge and thus grows healthier because of that, right? And for us today, it's going outside in the damn cold weather. That's hormesis by itself, right? That your body has to adapt to that challenge and regulate to make that happen. So anyways, the whole book is a marvel. It's a long, long book. It's going to take me a while to read it, but I'm really enjoying it. And I'm just like, it's so common sense and makes so much, is so practical and applicable for our lives, right? You know, the more we make good food choices, the more we have good activity, right? And of course, there's too much. You're going to have too much activity as well, right? But you have the activity level that is optimal or at least enough, maybe even a little more than enough to maintain good health, and the importance of social relationships as well, right? And of our thought process, what we think, you know, about ourselves and what we, the self-talk that we have regarding ourselves and those relationships we have other people as being so healing and so helpful to our kind of our well-being, right? So, yeah.
It is amazing. And I know that our bodies do talk to us. You know, I hurt my knee last week quite badly and the doctor told me to stay off my knee. And so it's been a week now that I've been off my knee, and I don't get a ton of exercise, obviously, because I'm dealing with the mobility issues. But right, even the small amount that I'm missing now, my body craves it. Like, I woke up last night and I found myself stretching and moving just because my body's like, yeah, we're not happy with this. Like, even the small amount of movement that we use normally, your body likes it, even though it might be painful, even though it might be a discomfort or a pain in the neck. It's our bodies tell us. It's like you said, you know, it doesn't take a genius to choose an apple over a donut, right?
Right.
But I think also our bodies will tell us, you know, what levels we need in lots of things, in nutrients, in activity. And not everyone's designed to be a swimmer, but
yes,
nor is anyone designed to sit on a couch for 18 hours a day. Like, right, there's, you know what I mean? There's a lot of variation in what people's bodies are designed to do, because we are all different, right? There's no, I strong, and I know you do too, strongly disagree with this idea that oh, there's a, you know, a common level of exercise that we all need, that there's this perfect weight for all human beings and those things. There's a mix for everyone, right? A level of activity. But we know that, you know, sitting doing nothing is bad for us. And our bodies rebel until they finally give up. And our bodies will give up if we just don't listen, right?
Definitely. Yeah, exactly.
No, but I've really found that a little bit of action, that your body will respond just as quickly to something that's good for you. Haven't you found that in your journey to health?
It takes very little. Well, small changes can have huge, huge results. Definitely. You bet.
Yeah. And yes. I think that Dr. Chestnut's work has some great examples of how he's not judging any of us. Like he talks about his own, you know, what he does and what he doesn't do. But there's always that encouragement that wherever you at or wherever you are at, you can start from there.
Right? Yes.
Like, you know, after I got sick in coma, I was over 600 pounds, like 635 pounds. I've lost 260 some pounds. You know, that's a whole person, right?
Definitely.
But every pound of that makes me feel better. Like, you can't even imagine how being that weight, how I can't even describe it, you know, how draining and demoralizing, and especially when you're not even, it doesn't matter what the situation is, whether it's medical, whether it's habit, whatever it is, even a pound or two improves your life so greatly.
Definitely.
And now I'm really sensitive to it because, like Dr. Chestnut and we talk about, just being aware and listening to that voice, you know, my body wants to keep losing weight. It doesn't, it's encouraging me, it's rewarding me by better health in stages, right? Like I've been at it for 12 years now, but it, you know, and the doctors told me, they said it's going to take, you know, up to 20 years before I'm going to see a normal health pattern if I work really hard.
Yes.
But every step, and I'm saying this because I think that sometimes people give up and they're like, oh, I'm 100 pounds overweight, I'm never going to get there.
Right.
You know, and it's just not true. Nope. You know, there's nothing special about me except that I'm me. And, you know, I just keep plugging away at it.
Yeah.
You know, and I fall off the wagon and, you know, winter's harder than summer and whatever. But everyone out there, for whatever reason, like with Alan, COVID changed his life dramatically. Just the conditions of COVID, right?
Yeah.
For me, it was getting incredibly sick and turning into, you know, the Michelin man. Don't wait for those things. You know, just your body and life and your friends and partners, everyone will be rewarded by, you know, making a little better choice in your food habits, a little better choice in your exercise.
Now, even if you have mobility issues, I know you like to hum, vocalize, all those kind of things, right, Scott? Yep,
absolutely. All right.
So now when you do, you create a ventral vagus response in your body, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anybody can do this. This is no big, like anybody can do it, right? And in creating a ventral vagus response, you actually kind of encourage your body, your mind to be connected, and that it puts you in a super healing type state. So the more that you can do that, the better off in terms of your healing. And I know really you know, you have a path, you have a mountain to climb, but everything step you take is going to assist in making that happen, right? Would you agree?
Oh, I agree. And I've learned this a lot since, you know, being your friend and learning with you, is sound, whether you make the sound or whether you listen to it. You know, like I always said, I don't play any instruments, but I play a tape deck really well. To our younger viewers, they won't have any idea what I'm talking about.
No.
But, you know, even if you, if you're absolutely to the point that you refuse to grunt like I do in a rhythm, what I consider a rhythm, which probably isn't one, you know, listening to music does have stimulating effects.
Definitely.
Sound is incredible, right?
And even better is if you're vocalizing yourself, right? Whatever that sound sounds like, and your voice, there's only one Scott Sweetman voice in the whole world, right? And so your voice, the more you use it, the better it will get, right? That's the reality of it. But I wanted to share this little video with you. I was watching this Ari Witten, and he has four videos, And this is on video 3. And he's talking about stimulating a ventral vagus response. And guess what? The number one way to stimulate a ventral vagus response is, don't say it, wait for the video, but you'll know it. I'm sure you will. Hang on, let me share screen. Okay, here we go. Let's go here. All right, here it comes.
Okay, this little practice will supercharge your brain for the day ahead. It will help to reset your brain and your nervous system, take it out of chronic stress mode, put it into relaxation, rejuvenation mode, and dramatically improve your energy levels. Here's what it consists of. A little breathing practice for 3 to 5 minutes, self-massage or foam rolling, or also called self-myofascial release, or massage from your partner. If you live with someone who's willing to give you a massage, that's the best scenario. Sing a song that you love. Okay. Now, this maybe sounds like a bizarre recommendation, but believe it or not, singing is one of the most powerful ways to stimulate that ventral vagal system, get you into a state of relaxation, and increase your vagal tone. Singing is one of the most powerful ways to take your brain and your nervous system out of stress mode. So I highly recommend that you sing a song, find a song that you love, sing it, and don't be shy. Don't be afraid to get goofy and get wild. The more that you can smile and laugh at yourself and have fun with the whole thing, the better it will be. The more you will take your brain out of stress mode. So find a song you love, pretend you're a rock star, go wild, do it every morning. The louder you sing and the more you get that vibration going in your vocal cords, the more you're going to stimulate that ventral vagal system. And then I'm going to give you.
Yes. Okay. I'm sure that you knew where I was going with this, didn't you?
I did. I'm sure our viewers did too. But that's a great, great little summary, right? That's fantastic.
Yes, it is. And singing, like just the whole experience of it. Listening to music is great, but singing is better. And it doesn't matter what your voice sounds like. Sing in your car with the windows closed if you feel that you must. But singing, I've been doing it more in public now as of late as well. And I've been having a lot of fun with it. And it's just because I know it's so healing for me. The other day I went to go get my MRI, I told you, right? So I'm going there at 7:30 in the morning. There's nobody around the place. So while I'm walking down the hall, I'm, you know, singing a song. Jeremiah was a bullfrog. Oh, he was a good friend of mine. Anyways, there's my tip for today.
Yeah, I think it's doable by anyone. And, you know, if you're by yourself, you don't have to be ashamed of it. I think the singing in public thing, I was thinking about that. And I know growing up, we used to sing all the time on the school bus and at football games or, you know, it was much more common, I think, than now. Like,
I think,
and
so
I wondered about, like, I was around when the Walkman came out. Like that's, you know, people think it's a retro piece now. But I remember saving up to buy a Walkman to ski with, right?
Yes.
And I think we moved a lot of our music in internal rather than external, yeah. Where I know that before that whole trend to wearable music and headphones, now you see everyone with headphones on. Yeah. But growing up, okay, I grew up in Hicktown, but you would hear people humming as you walk by them on the street. You would hear people, you know, at church during mass or services or at the school, you would hear singing from the, you know, the carrot school, which was a kindergarten my grandma taught at. And there was just singing, public singing all over the place, right?
Yeah,
like, you know, you'd go into the little store and there'd be country music playing on the old transistor radio and the clerk Vera would be singing along, terrible voice, but she was a really scary person, but she was really nice on the inside. But yeah, but don't try and steal a candy. She'd cut you in half. But yeah, no, what do you think? Like, I think public singing has been replaced by a very private kind of.
I think you have a great insight that is true. And I also think people are super sensitive about their voice and any criticism about that, even when they're a small person, right? Like where their mother might have said, like, would you shut the hell up already? You've been singing for 5 hours, like quit, yeah. Right? That's enough that they don't, right? Or that somebody, you know, says that they have a bad voice or they don't mm-hmm. sound good, that kind of a thing, right? And then as well with more availability of hearing professionals, like people who are getting, you know, that make a living singing, obviously they're, you know, I shouldn't say obviously, because there's some people that I don't understand how they're popular in terms of their singing. That, you know, do you remember that song? Geez, what's it called now? Where, oh, where can my baby be? The Lord took her away from me. Yep. So that was a song in 1958 by J. Wilson Forge, I believe it was. But then there was a rock band did it, and I can't remember the guy's name. It was horrible. He has a terrible voice. The original version was way, way better. But my point is that people who hear a professional singer and say, oh, well, I'm not that good, so I can't sing. But I had Carolla shared with me this little interview from Ed Sheeran, and Ed Sheeran said, you know what, here, let me play you a song that I sang when I was 16 years old. And his voice was not good at all. It was cracking and all over the place and that kind of a thing. But now after 4 or 5 years of singing, right, and probably getting some instruction and some coaching and that kind of thing, and probably doing some exercises to kind of, you know, build up his capacity to sing, then he's a beautiful singer now, right? Like, you know, that. So that's kind of the point, is that if we just say, professionals, I can't do this because the professionals got it. Bullshit. Do it. Everybody, your voice is as important as anybody else's voice. Your voice is one of the whole world, that your voice that you have. So sing. Yeah, do it. It's great for you. It fills your soul with joy. It's good for you physically. You're working that diaphragm. And as you work that diaphragm, it massages all your internal organs. It creates that ventral vagus response. There's like zero downside to it. And if somebody doesn't like it, you know, that's okay. Or ask them, okay, great, here, bring it on. You can sing better than me. I would love to hear you sing that. You know,
I was just going to say that I think a lot of the popular TV shows over the last 10 years have made singing a competition, right? True. There's been The Voice and America's Got Talent, England, Britain's Got Talent. I can't remember what it was called. Anyway, so many of them where these ordinary people come up and they sound angelic, or they're like mad rappers or whatever. And I really think that young people are intimidated, thinking that, oh, well, you know, like you said, there's, you know, average people sound great, but I sound terrible. Because we also, more than any time in history, hear our own recorded voice. Yes. Right. And we sound different when we're recorded than we do in our own head, to do with the vibration and inner ear and all those things.
Definitely.
And everyone who hears, like when we're doing videos or audio for work and things, the first time somebody hears their voice, they're always like, do I really sound like that? Did you change that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, no, that's how you sound. And they're like, oh, I sound so terrible. And you're like, no, you sound great. That's how you sound all the time. You know? Yeah. And then you get people trying to change their voice. Right. And it's like, no, just do it the way you did it the first time. It's great. Yes. But I think there's that psychological block, and some of it's cultural, I think, because I know that culturally, when I've done a lot of traveling, there's other cultures that people just sing. It's expected. Everyone joins in. And
I see like lots of appliances. If you go where there's some folks from the Philippines who are working in like a restaurant kind of a thing, they're singing all the time, right? And I think it's beautiful, right? Like they'll just chime in and sing songs. And in terms of for your well-being, it's great. For others to hear it, it's enjoyable, right? And so, and you just have to kind of the haters and the ones that are going to be critical of it, you just have to ignore them. Just let, you know, whatever, they have their opinion, and let them have their opinion. That's fine. So, and I guess another thing too, that I think a lot of times people won't sing because they don't see where they're the value in it. Well, am I going to make any money singing? Am I going to be part of a band? You don't have to do it for those reasons. Just do it for your edification, your enjoyment, just for what it does for you. So, yeah.
Well, and there's so many things. I know that many years ago when I was really active in the Anglican Church, I used to do a service on Sundays at the palliative care ward. And when I started doing it, the person in charge, wonderful lady, and the priest at that time said, you know, you're going to obsess about this, but really you're just going there to spread some good words, let people know, oh, we have a thumbs down there. What was that?
I don't know. Like, yeah, they had the thumbs down on my screen, but I don't see it anywhere. I don't know how that happened, but okay.
Oh, well, anyway. And so they said, you know, what we really need is just some good news, a little bit of Bible passage that they're familiar with, you know, seniors would be familiar with. So we use the old book, not the revised book, and singing. You know, they said, make sure you've got 4 or 5 good hymns and the seniors will join right in and they'll leave happier than they came in. And it was so amazing. And yeah, you know, I took it really seriously because I was young and I researched the passages and my little homily and whatever, but they were there for the singing and they loved it. And a lot of them would say, you know, I'm not religious or I'm not Anglican, but I know those songs. And they always left more energized and happier than they came. And it was really down, I believe, to a little bit of positivity, but still that singing out loud and getting that breath going. And I think the underlying message here is you don't have to go to the gym, although that's great. You don't have to be, you know, work your body to be an Olympic class swimmer. Even little things like making simple choices in your food, singing a little, breathing a little better can put you on that path.
Definitely. Well said. Small incremental adjustments. And by the way, we do have a like from Deb Nickel. Thanks, Deb, for giving us a like. I don't know where the thumbs down came from. It seemed to be one for me, but I did not give you a thumbs down, Scott, while you were talking. So, but the other day, my
Zoom. While I was talking, does that mean you were giving me a thumbs down when I wasn't talking?
No, I wasn't giving you a thumbs down at all. So I don't know where that came from. So, but the other day I had something goofy happen when I was in a Zoom call too, where it just kind of, there was, oh yeah, it was like one of those celebration fireworks. Little things, yeah. Fireworks. I say, I didn't ask for that. Okay, thanks. Okay, we got to wrap it up. I'm going
to wrap it up because, yes, health and happiness start at home in your heart, and your missus needs you to join her for a little bit of health and happiness tonight.
Ooh, oh, where's there that? We you go. See that? I had some sparkly things come on my screen. Yeah. I didn't do that. Did you do that?
No, I haven't touched anything. So.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know where that came from. It had some little sparklies that happened there.
It's so. Magic.
Yeah, unless I'm having a brain aneurysm or something.
No, I saw them too. So okay, it's one of those emoji app things. So I don't know. Maybe we're hacked. But you got to get going. So from my very good friend, the acapellist Alan Friesen, and myself, Scott Sweetman, have a great week. And we'll be back next week. And we might have some pictures to show you of the inside of Alan's brain. Well, great Halloween show, right? Yeah.
All right, get him out soon. See you next week.
Take care. Thanks very much.